Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Silence and the spotlight collided last week, and the fallout could change the way the press reports rape. When Jacqueline Maris and Tamara Brooks were abducted from a lover's lane north of Los Angeles, law enforcement officials and the media released their names in the hope that broad publicity would help get the teenagers back. It did. But when a sheriff revealed that the girls had been sexually assaulted, journalists everywhere faced a quandary. Continue publishing the girls' names despite the revelation, or revert to a long-standing policy of privacy for rape victims. The journalism community was divided. It all became a moot point when the girls told their story on national television the morning after their rescue. But the larger question about allowing rape victims to remain anonymous remains. Those who've applauded the girls' decision to go public say that the real stigma of rape comes from the silence it forces onto victims. Connection listeners, should the press reconsider its policy on rape victims? In a tell-all age, is publicity the best therapy? Or could it be a deterrent to women who would otherwise seek treatment and justice? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Kelly McBride, who's a member of the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, and by Gail Arbarbanel, the founder and director of the Rape Treatment Center at the Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center. Kelly McBride, I'll start with you. Would we be having this conversation today if it weren't for these two teenagers from Antelope Valley, California?
I don't think we'd be having it on a national level. It's important to know that we've always been having this conversation, and we don't seem to be advancing it at all in the media. The spotlight was so glaring on this case that I think it's changed the conversation.
Gail Arbarbanel, do you think that it's changed the conversation? Are we seriously, deeply rethinking whether or not to automatically publish rape victims' names? And would this, in your judgment, remove the stigma?
In my judgment, it wouldn't remove the stigma, but I think the media is having this conversation by itself without the victims. And I think if we listen carefully to all of the interviews that the victims have done, they're not talking about rape. The only people talking about rape are the media. So I really think that the media has made this into a story that doesn't match the reality. I don't think these young women are coming forward as rape victims.
Kelly, help us understand what the hand-wringing is about for journalists. We had a picture here with the sheriff being the one who released the information. It's just him so far who has said that the girls were sexually assaulted. And newspapers and news outlets everywhere thinking whether or not to retract the names, to go forward with the names. Where does this leave us as a journalism community?
Well, historically, media outlets have not published the names of rape victims without their consent because there has been a serious amount of shame, a huge stigma attached to the crime of rape. That has been changing because of a lot of things. We frequently see more and more rape victims suing in civil courts, as we do in the clergy abuse phenomenon. And because of that, I think we are lowering that bar for our standards for publishing rape victims, so the names of rape victims. So last week, when we had, or 2 weeks ago, when we had the sheriff from Los Angeles announce on live television that these girls had been raped, it was almost midnight, I believe, on the East Coast by the time that news filtered, you know, the 30 minutes that it took to filter into the wire stories. And newspaper editors were caught in a bind because the names had been very, very public. And most newspapers pulled the names and applied their policy, but some very major newspapers, including the Boston Globe and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Miami Herald, did not pull their names. And at the time, those news editors decided that because the names were out there and because maybe we're in a place in society where there is not as much stigma attached to rape, that in this specific case they would publish those names. They were in the minority, but there was a large minority. minority.
Mm-hmm. Gail, talk to me about stigma. When a rape victim is decides to come forward, as these girls did, it seems to me that they have already made a judgment about whether or not they have been stigmatized. Nobody forced them to go on national television. Nobody forced them to be on the cover of People magazine.
Well, I don't think the decision about adopting a policy that would almost compel victims to have their name published if they reported these crimes should be based, first of all, I don't think it should be based on a very unusual case with very unique circumstances. In other words, that the names were out there before anyone disclosed anything about a sexual assault. I think the most important thing for rape victims is having a choice, and public disclosure of a victim's name should be a victim's choice. I don't think it should be a matter of news media policy. And I think if we adopted that policy, which would in effect link the victim's decision to get medical care, to reach out for help, to make a police report, to essentially agreeing to have her name in the local newspaper the next day, many, many victims would remain silent and not get the help they need and not report these crimes.
Is this a crime like any other crime?
I think it's unlike any other crime, and the reason it's different is because of the violation victims suffer, but also because of the discriminatory attitudes they encounter in a lot of different arenas. And when we have made dramatic changes, and victims have so many more rights and protections in the criminal justice system, hospitals' care is much more sensitive and advanced in terms of forensics and evidence collection, and police departments have made dramatic changes in how they respond to these cases. But still, I think any prosecutor would agree that in most cases, the victim is still on trial in that courtroom.
Do you buy the argument, as these girls seem to have put forward, that by talking about it, certainly I've read that their parents say that this is what they say, they have ameliorated the stigma, they have, to some degree, found a way to balance what happened to them?
They're not talking about rape.
But they are talking about overcoming an assault, an abduction, empowering themselves?
Right, but I think it's important to, if we're having a discussion about what this means for rape victims and for media policy about rape, I really think that this, they are not coming forward as rape victims. They're coming forward as young women who survived an incredibly horrible, life-threatening, terrifying, terrorizing experience. And, you know, they're talking about it in the immediate aftermath. I don't think we really know what the impact of this is going to be on them in the long term.
Gail, this is Kelly. Can I ask you, what do you think I'm wondering, what does it mean that they're not talking about rape?
That's a good question.
I mean, what are the implications of that?
Can we say that they are deciding selectively what to keep private and what to put forward, Gail?
You know, my understanding is that there were some parameters set on what would and would not be talked about. But maybe some of you in the media know more about that. I don't.
Well, this is Kelly again. I'm wondering if that furthers the stigma or at least reinforces the fact that there is a lot of shame and stigma associated with rape still in this day and age.
Well, I think in many cultures and in many communities and for many individuals, it's not only shame and stigma, it's blame. I think it's that the responsibility for rape is often placed on the victim. And that's one of the reasons that victims are reluctant to come forward and talk about. They fear being blamed. And they also fear retaliation. So having, again, a public policy or a newspaper policy that would routinely disclose their names, I think also would make many victims more fearful about the consequences of coming forward. And actually, in California, we have a law that gives rape victims the right to remain anonymous on a crime report so that if a police report is released as a matter of public record, and the press is one group that can get a public record, their identifying information would not be on it. And I think that's good public policy because it addresses the fears victims feel about public exposure and retaliation for reporting.
Kelly. One of the issues that we deal with in the media is the issue of fairness, that oftentimes when a rape is reported, we don't print the victim's name, but we print the person who's been accused. And there are people who feel like that is an unfair situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a fuller question that can be seen as damaging suspects. And I think it's another good question for the press to explore. In this case, I'm wondering, Gail, what victims tell you about whether or not to use their names? There might also be a question of just keeping this private, of people not wanting it to be discussed, I suppose. What do you hear from the women that you see?
You know, we saw four victims at our rape treatment center last night, and I can't imagine what it would be like for them to be confronted with this, with a dilemma or a conflict at the time they're raped. And they want to make a police report, or they want to get medical care, or they want to have evidence collected, and they have to grapple with a choice that would mean public exposure, you know, at that moment. I think that most victims would choose not to have their name publicized, because a lot of them haven't even had a chance to deal with telling their family or making decisions about, you know, who they're going to tell and what they're going to do. So I think that adopting a policy like this really eliminates a lot of options for victims.
Mm-hmm. Kelly McBride, there was also a real feeding frenzy, was there not, around who would get these girls on national television. And that certainly seems to add to an element of, I'm going to say the word, sensationalism around this, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. And there you have to look at where the news media switches its motivations from journalism to entertainment motivations. You know, that the feeding frenzy to get those girls on morning shows and to nail down exclusive interviews is very unseemly.
Does their use of the word celebrity, one of them said, I guess you could not call us celebrities, make you as an ethicist uncomfortable?
You know, I would never criticize anything the girls themselves are doing. I think that, you know, they, more power to them for taking control of the situation. What makes me uncomfortable is seeing my colleagues at various media outlets falling all over themselves to nail down interviews with these girls, because when you ask the question, why are they doing this, there really is very little journalistic motivation, and it's fairly prurient, their interest at this point.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, Gail, does that question make you uncomfortable?
Which question?
If they call themselves celebrities, that point.
You know, I also feel like I don't want to comment on them on them individually. I think they made a choice. They feel that they're getting support for coming forward and for their courage and bravery and their incredible coping in a really dangerous situation. But I do feel that they did not make the choice to have the rape part of their experience publicized.
All right. We'll consider the question of whether or not the press should make the choice to publish a rape victim's name when we come back. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston.
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection. And we're talking in this hour about how the media covers rape in the wake of the abduction of two teenage girls in California recently. The number to call to join in the conversation is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes The Connection. I'm joined now by Kelly McBride, who's a member of the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, and Gail Arbarbanel, the founder and director of the Rape Treatment Center at the Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center. Center. And I'd like to introduce my other guest on the show. Jane Shore Meisner is a freelance writer. In 1991, she won the Pulitzer Prize for Meritorious Public Service for a five-part series that she wrote for the Des Moines Register newspaper about a rape victim's decision to go public. Jane Shore Meisner, welcome.
Good morning.
Your series in the Register was, I think, the first piece of journalism to identify a rape victim by name. It was considered to be a landmark series. Tell us a little bit about how this came about. You must be watching everything that's happening in these weeks with great interest. But
Yes, I certainly am. Even after it's been 12 years since our series ran, and I am watching all of this with very much interest. I want to make clear, though, that ours was not, in fact, the first major publication to run a story like this. It's interesting that it had been done in other newspapers, particularly the Washington Post, many years before. For some reason, ours in 1990 was the one that was at the right time, was at the time when people were ready to talk about this. And the reaction that we got to our five-part series was just overwhelming. It came about because the editor of the Des Moines Register at that time, Geneva Overholser, had written an innocent opinion piece talking about this issue of the media naming rape victims' names, and she expressed the opinion that if women were more willing to talk about it and come forward, that it would reduce the stigma. From that article, a woman here in central Iowa did come to the Register and say, well, if you really think this will help, I'd be willing to tell my story and you can use my name. She gave us permission from the outset. I was assigned to the story, and it...
What was her name? Just in the interest of full record.
Her name was Nancy Ziegenmeier. And she was a housewife from central Iowa. I began working with her on the story, and we just thought it would be, you know, a small piece in the daily paper. But what happened was the trial of her accused attacker was continued and delayed for a number of months. I ended up working with her for 7 months and unintentionally gathered enough material to kind of make a diary of what she went through in her attempt to heal from this and her frustrations with the legal system and so forth. We ended up running a five-part series, had no idea that there would be the reaction that there was, and I spent the next year, at least year of my life, answering phone calls every day about the issue of rape victims and should names be printed in the media.
You know, just as you're talking, I'm listening and thinking about the months of processing and thinking about whether or not to go forward, how much Nancy wanted to say, how much dialogue she had with you privately about what she wanted to say. As you look at these girls going from abduction one day and the very next day, or after the release, that is, being on TV, what goes through your mind about how much consideration they and their families gave this?
I'm very concerned about these girls, and I applaud them for their bravery, and I agree 100% that it is their right to make the decision of what they want to do, and none of us should criticize whether that is right or wrong. But I am concerned. First of all, these are young gals. They're 16 and 17-year-olds old. They're teenagers. I think that they probably have no idea what a person can get into when they go from being a private citizen to being thrust in the media spotlight. And that's the case in any situation. Any reason a person becomes a media celebrity, or even a person. I used to write feature stories for the Register, and if I wrote a story about a person who has a great stamp collection and the attention that they would get and the phone calls and the letters, and this is just 100,000 times more. Mm-hmm. And I have read where they've already been contacted by movie producers. Probably by now they should be considering having an agent to handle the book deals and all this. It is overwhelming. This is some of what we experienced with our story that we were not prepared for.
You mean Nancy became a bit of a celebrity?
Oh, she became a major celebrity, and it went beyond that. The editor of the Register became a celebrity. I myself had to deal with all this, and I was the reporter who's not supposed to be in part of the story. I was supposed to report it, and I ended up, you know, in a situation where I was stepping out of the shower in the morning and the phone was ringing, and here was CBS calling saying, can you fly to New York the next day? It was overwhelming for me, and I was a 30-year-old adult, and these are kids. I'm real concerned about what the long-term effect will be. I think they will be emotionally exhausted on top of just having gone through a trauma.
Mm-hmm. Gail or Barbanel, this is not, of course, what happens to most rape victims, probably not exactly to any other person who's undergone this crime before. What do you think the consequence could be of, and tell me how rape is different from any other crime. I'd like to ask you that and Kelly that. A rape, in preparing for this hour, reading many editorials about it, one of the best lines I wrote was the bluntest. It's not like any other crime because it's the only crime committed with a penis.
Well, I think it's the nature of the crime that's different, and it's also the public society's view of the crime that's very different from other crimes. There are historically different legal standards for rape victims than for any other crime victims, and some of those have been changed. You know, we used to have resistance standards. We used to require corroboration. There used to be a mandatory jury instruction that said rape is a charge easily made, so examine the testimony of this witness, the victim, with caution. I mean, rape victims were really subjected to a different standard than any other crime victim.
Well, and I also think, this is Kelly, as a society, we have a different reaction to rape than we have to any other crime. And this, I've been researching this for a piece that I'm writing on how the media treats rape victims. And one rape victim told me that she didn't want to have her rape revealed because she didn't want people thinking about what had happened to her, envisioning and imagining the actual crime. We don't have that problem with other violent crimes.
Well, we want to know if there's someone on the loose in a community, if our house has been burglarized or someone has been stabbed. And, of course, you want to know if a rape has been committed. But I think the question we're asking is whether the disclosure is more intimate, more personal than in other cases. Let's take phone calls. Connection listeners, we'll put that question to you, whether or not a rape victim's name should be revealed. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jane, you're calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I would like to comment. First of all, my real name is not Jane, and that should tell you my answer right there. I was raped when I was 16 years old.
How old are you now?
I'm 26. The simple fact is that rape is a removal of power from the victim. And it is extremely important to me as a woman to be able to have my power to choose who I tell my story to. So if someone were to, you know, if I were to have chosen to report this to police and automatically it became announced to the world that this had happened to me, that is almost, it's not another rape, but it's a second removal of that power from the survivor. And that's another thing that I wanted to mention also, the use of the word victim and the use of the word survivor. I call myself a rape survivor because I have chosen not to let this ruin my life. Many women who do not have this, you know, who haven't found the courage yet to fight back, they can call themselves a victim, and that's fine. But the women who have chosen to speak out and have chosen, even if it's just extremely personal, but to heal, you know, to begin the healing process, it's really important to use the word survivor.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Kelly McBride, Is there, for the larger community, anything useful to be gained if someone who has been raped or a rape survivor's name is published, in terms of humanizing the event or interpreting the event or making it, I don't know, more real to the community?
Oh, I definitely think that the mission of journalism is to tell the truth, and that with a name and with the victim, the survivor's perspective, I think that you can do a better job telling the truth. One of the things that I am that has surprised me as I've watched these girls go on television and go in People magazine is it occurred to me that one of the messages that they're saying is that rape does not have to ruin your life, that you can get on with your life and that you can survive it, that you don't have to be a victim. We tend to have a very limited understanding of what happens to rape victims because we have been limited in our ability to tell their stories by the rule that says you can't print their names, because oftentimes in the media, when we tell a story without a name, it is seen as less credible by the viewers or the readers.
Mm-hmm. Jane, do you think there would have been, in the case of your crime, any component of usefulness to the community had your name been published? And also, I'm curious what you might say if you had the chance to. I'm sure these young women will be hearing from people like yourself, what you'd say to them.
I personally don't know that. You know, that's funny that I would say that, because, yes, one of the things that I'm thinking about doing is going back to the high school that I went to and telling my story, because it happened to me while I was in high school and I had no idea what was going on. One of the things that I would say to these girls is to just make sure that they step back and take the time to let themselves grieve. I blocked all of this out of my mind for 4 years, and it hit me when I was in college and I made myself violently ill. I almost had to drop out of college because of the force of the emotions that I did not let myself feel initially.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think I would make sure that they, you know, give themselves time to have their personal grieving and begin the healing process, and do it in a personal way and not in front of the entire nation, because it is an extraordinarily personal crime.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Jane Shore, as Nancy's name became public, did it for Nancy Ziegenmeier, did it for Iowans personalize this story in a way that meant you received more response to the crime, more response to women's situations in Iowa generally? Was there an outpouring, in other words, from the community that became clearer and stronger because she had published the name as opposed to withholding it?
Yes, in our case, it certainly did. In fact, that was the effect of the whole story, that she was just an ordinary person, just a private citizen, and that's what people seem to be able to relate to. We had response even from reporters in our own newsroom who came up and said, you know, my sister was raped, or my cousin was raped, or my college roommate, and they never talked about it before, but somehow this gave them permission to, or something. That's the effect that our story had. Other stories shortly after that, or around the same time, in other publications, got zero response. I have never personally been able to figure that out, except I would like to think that ours was effective because of how it humanized this particular woman.
All right. Let's take another call. We're discussing rape on The Connection and whether or not the media should publish the names of people who've been raped and what they might have to say about it. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking now with Chase. Hello, Chase. You're calling from Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. I agree with the victim. I think that it's definitely there are some things that maybe aren't necessarily the right of the media to expose. It's the or the survivor, as she called it. I think that it's their choice. And when you do remove an individual, some things just aren't a matter of public information. Some things are the individual choice. I think with rape in general, one of the things that has maybe led to the stigma that it's a shame crime is that a lot of the rape cases just aren't pursued or prosecuted. And also, you're really talking about a lot of civil liberties issues when you start talking about should the name of the accused also be withheld.
And, mm-hmm. Chase, have you ever been mugged, ever been robbed?
I have been attacked, yes.
And did you feel a sense of violation?
There are occasions outside of great violence where I oftentimes feel a sense of violation. Yes, I have felt violated.
If this, I'm just being theoretical here, were to have been the kind of crime that affected you, that occurred within your community, made it into the newspapers, would you have felt that you had the right to have your name withheld?
Okay, well, let me answer that this way. I dated a girl for 5 years. And that girl was molested by a relative. So I'm kind of close to the situation we're talking about. During the 5 years, I wanted her to be able to talk about it and tell her story. But I realized it was not my decision to make. It was her decision to do whatever it is that she wanted to do with it. It's hers. She owns it. Not me. And if someone, and that's exactly what the survivor that just was on the phone was saying. It's theirs. They own that. And if you take it away from, if you print it without their consent, you have taken it away from them. And you have, taken power out of their hands.
Okay. Thank you, Chase. I guess that you'd agree with Chase's comment, Gail or Barbanel.
Well, I think that it is important and it's very helpful. It has a huge impact when victims tell their story and tell the details of their story. When they, like Nancy Ziegenmeier, decided on her own to come forward and tell, and as Jane, the survivor, said, she had control of the decision and she was empowered by doing that. But routine publishing of names would be very different, and I'm not sure that the public would be changed or would learn that much from reading a name. I mean, reading the Nancy Ziegenmeier story was much more illuminating.
All right. Thank you, Gail. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. We're speaking about rape and whether or not the media should cover it by disclosing the names of people who've been raped. When we come back, you'll be listening to The Connection on NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University,
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection from NPR. And we're talking in this hour about rape and how the media treats this most intimate of crimes. The number to call to get in on the conversation is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Gail R. Barbanel, the founder and director of the Rape Treatment Center at Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center, Jane Shore Meisner, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and freelance writer, and Kelly McBride, a member of the Ethics Faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. Kelly, should we have a hard and fast rule about rape and the media? Do we make it easier for ourselves if we say that we will suppress the names of all rape victims? Would it be easier if we said we'll publish the names of all rape victims? And what do you imagine we would get into if we decided to cover it on a case-by-case basis with different newspapers and news outlets following different policies?
Well, I think we have guidelines in the media. I don't think we have any hard and fast rules, and that has to do with the First Amendment and the history of the free press in this country. So we have guidelines, and I think the guidelines are good, but I think what we don't have enough of is a good process for discussing what might be exceptions to the guidelines, as was the case in California. And I think we need, I think we're at a watershed moment here now in the media and in society. And I think that the reason the Des Moines article in 1990 got so much attention was we were at a watershed moment at that point in time as well. And when you're at a watershed moment, I think that's when, in addition to good guidelines, I think you need a good process where you can bring in other people, other than just the media, where you can talk to victims, where you can understand what's going on, and you can make decisions quickly, but you can make good decisions as well.
All right, let's talk to some more callers. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection. Louise is calling from Hampton, Virginia. Hello, Louise.
Hi.
Thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you very much.
And what's your comment, Louise?
Well, I understand that these girls were raped. I am a rape victim myself. And I feel sorry for them. But I feel like they should have some kind of program that everyone can go to and talk about this, that when it happened to them as a young girl at the age of 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not stop until I was 12 years old.
In other words, you were raped as a young child, Louise?
Yes.
You were 5?
Yes. And it's pain.
Where have you been able to discuss this, Louise?
Well, I was 22 years old, and I started telling different people about it. Because what happened to me is I thought having different boyfriends would heal me inside. And I was looking for something to heal the pain. And that was not the way to go.
How old are you today?
50 years old. And I haven't been able to explain it the way it should be explained.
Mm-hmm. Gail or Barbanel, here we have a case. Louise's question is that this is something she's been living with her entire life. I mean, how common is this?
It's so common because rape and child sexual abuse are so prevalent. In the latest research done by the CDC found that 1 in 6 women has been a victim of rape or attempted rape. So it's very prevalent. And I think what's important is that it's never too late to get help. There are crisis centers and counseling agencies that have expertise in providing treatment and help for sexual assault victims, even if it happened a long time ago. So I really encourage you to find a place where you can get this kind of help.
And this is Kelly. This is a spot where I think the media can actually make a difference if they could publicize those resources. And if they could give people like Louise a chance to, if they could tell the story of someone like Louise so that people out there who need help can see that I'm not the only one who suffered this indignation. And here is how somebody else has dealt with it. It would just provide a better resource for people.
And I think identifies one of the other problems in how the media covers rape, because most of the rape stories that the media covers are stranger rape stories, and the most prevalent kind of rape is acquaintance rape. I mean, most women who are sexually victimized are victimized by someone they know,
mm-hmm.
and that's very underreported by the media.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Louise.
Thank you, and I have another question. If someone would want to do something like that, get in touch with me, and I have a lot to tell them.
Okay.
A lot.
Right, well, we thank you so much for calling in. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Gail or Barbanel, is it therapeutic for someone to immediately talk to the press? In your judgment, you've been counseling rape victims for 20 years. And are we to think that there is perhaps something glib in feeling that these girls have dealt with it? I mean, they have not had very much time. They've been applauded for coming forward, and I'm making quotation marks in the air here, dealing with it. Have they dealt with it?
Well, I think, you know, nobody deals with a rape completely in the first few weeks, and talking to the media is not therapy. It may be therapeutic. I think it is therapeutic to talk about what happened, and talking about it is one of the first steps in the healing process, but we say that in the context of a therapeutic relationship. You know, talking about it to someone who understands and knows how to help and is supportive, that's very different than talking about it on national television.
But the therapeutic environment helps you process something.
Right.
I don't know. Does going on national television achieve the same effect?
Well, I don't think we know that, and I also think there may be a difference in talking about it in the media after you've had a chance to process it. and talking about it immediately. I mean, most victims in the immediate aftermath are in a state of shock. You know, they're numb, and it would be very difficult for many victims to be questioned about it by the media.
Gail, this is Jane Shore Meisner. I would agree with that 100%. In our story, our news source, Nancy Ziegenmeier, had recovered for more than a year before she ever talked to us about it. And I think if she had tried to talk about it the day after, she just would have been hysterical. I am wondering, in the articles that I have read, I have not seen any place where the California girls have said, I was raped. I am a rape survivor, and I want to stand here and say that...
in fact,
you know,
it was the sheriff who said that they had been assaulted,
exactly.
And they declined to answer that question when they spoke to Katie Couric.
I think that's part of your point, Gail, that they aren't actually talking about the rape. They're talking about their ordeal, but if this is looked at as therapeutic, they aren't saying, I am a rape victim and I am not ashamed.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call here. Gretchen is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Gretchen.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. One aspect of why rape, I think, should be brought to light by the media, something that I'm not quite sure was really addressed at this point, is actually bringing it forward for the sake of boys, adolescent boys, and men trying to feel their way in terms of forming relationships with women. Because, you know, until we address rape as a social issue, not just as an act of violation of a personal protection, which, you know, it truly is, but to focus on why women are raped and what triggers a decision to use rape. And I think using the press to teach boys, adolescents, and even some men who might be confused in our society about what rape is, focusing as well as why rape occurs, and address that issue that needs to be addressed as a legitimate concern, or it'll just continue to increase. And to see the effects of rape, I think that's how the media can also be very important to do that. And most importantly, by continuing to focus on the victim solely and not trying to achieve a balance of addressing the cause and not just the effect. The cause will always continue. So I think the press can be used as an important tool to publish resources, not just for victims, but also to publish resources for men who may be at risk for committing rape.
All right. Gretchen, thank you for that call.
I agree with you completely.
Kelly.
This is Kelly. And
should that be a part of the mission of journalism? Should rape, the whys of rape, be a part of the package in terms of the media article about what happens?
Well, sure. If our mission is to tell the truth, then let's tell the whole truth. Let's tell the complex truth. And I think we have been artificially limited by our guidelines that say we don't print the names of rape victims. And I think it has kind of limited our creativity in even our energy that we take to address the issue.
I think in our attempt to try to give women some sense of empowerment on rape and trying to make them realize that it is an act of violation as well as, as well as, of course, the psychological aspects. But what I'm very concerned with is the men and boys in our society that, you know, are saying, okay, we're focusing on the rape victim as well, we should. But also, let's take a step back and say, you know, I would love to see the press be able to write stories about, well, what caused this boy to initiate the rape? Like, what was his background? And maybe by telling that story as well, maybe we could take a step back and say, maybe there'll be some kids out there that'll be like, oh my God, that's me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you completely.
Yes, I do too. That's an excellent point.
And I think this is the key to prevention. We're not going to stop rape by talking to women or about women. We're only going to stop rape if we start talking to men.
Jane Shore, in your series, did you discuss much the rapist?
I never interviewed the rapist. He was not quoted. The focus was not on him at all. And with that point that has just been brought up, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, that would have been a fascinating story to try to figure out, how he got to that point.
Gretchen?
Story. Thank you.
So, I'm sorry. Okay.
There's your next Pulitzer, Jane.
Well, I think that Gretchen has raised a good point for journalist Kelly McBride in that I don't think I have seen many stories that talked about the causes of rape. Certainly, they're not on the front page right next to the story of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
No, they haven't at all. I haven't seen that at all. And that's one of the many, many angles that we haven't talked about. Gail pointed out that, you know, most rapes are not stranger abductions. Most rapes are rapes where the person who is raped knows the person who does the raping. And in that case, you have to talk about relationships, and you have to talk about what happened in this relationship without being in a mode of blaming the victim. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to talk about the nuances of that, because about the stuff that was involved in it. If there was alcohol involved, if there was an antagonistic relationship, because, you know, like your caller just said, if I'm some guy sitting at home who thinks that if I get a girl drunk and buy her dinner, she owes me something, I have to be able to have that conversation, and I should be able to see it reflected in the media if I'm ever going to get the message that that's wrong.
Gail or Barbanel talked about a law in California, if I understand this correctly, Gail, that limits the media's access to a rape victim's name because it's not a matter of public record. Do you think that's a law that all states ought to have, or do you think that restricts press freedom?
Well, one of the things that's important about that law is that the police are required to inform the victim that he or she has the choice to keep their name off the police report, and then the victim can exercise that right.
Okay.
The one other thing I wanted to say about the media covering more about men and about how these crimes happen and the motivation of some of these sex offenders, I think it might create a different process in the courtroom, because the questions in the courtroom in a case like the one you described, where a man met a woman at a bar and she had a drink, the courtroom usually focuses on why did she drink, and it really should focus on why did he buy her a drink, and why was he looking for someone in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
And the question should be about the rapist rather than about the victim.
Right. There are many, many nuances that we have just not explored in the media
right.
at all.
And also, this is Jane, among the disturbing calls that I received after our story were from men who had been accused of rape who were innocent. And I think probably Gail could confirm that that is the exception rather than the rule. But as journalists, we need to remember that that could happen. It does happen. The last story that I wrote as a reporter for the Des Moines Register before I left was the story of a man who spent 10 years in prison convicted of a rape that he did not commit, and DNA eventually was able to prove that he didn't. So it's a very complicated issue.
Well, thank you very much to all my guests today. Kelly McBride is a member of the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute. Gail Arbarbanel is the founder and director of the Rape Treatment Center in Santa Monica, California. And the last person you heard from was Jane Shore Meisner, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and freelance writer. We had help today from Sandy Jonikin at the Poynter Institute. The Connection is produced by Sean Charberry, Lisa Chow, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WB.